السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. All praises are Allah's, Lord of the worlds. And may His peace and blessings be upon our Master, the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and His pure Immaculate Ahlul Bayt. Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad. I would first like to thank everyone here and those who have attended during the last few nights for your patience in relation to these few concepts that I've shared with you. And some of them may be difficult, but you can always return and listen to them again, and with time it will be digested, inshallah. But I felt that these were important concepts for you to acknowledge, not only in relation to Messianism, but in all our articles of faith. And I just want to thank the committee here for all their efforts in relation to the program, and also the Bayani family, with whom I've spent the last few days in their presence in their home, Mr. Bayani, his respected wife, and his sons. Okay. This is the now third lecture in relation to Messianism. The first two, we went through a number of principles, especially the concept of the intermediary, the luminous barzakh. And inshallah, today is the point on Messianism, which I would like to share with you. But I had to go through the process before opening this point. And it's an important point. I promise it won't be as long as last night's lecture, but it is a bit delicate. You have to just pay attention. And being the last lecture, if you just... Yes. Now we read in the traditions of the Ahlul Bayt that the 12th Imam, Imam Mahdi, ajalallahu ta'ala farajahu sharif, that His Eminence will reappear in Mecca. And his back will be behind the Kaaba, meaning supporting himself against the Kaaba. And he will utter the words, Ana baqiyatullah, wa baqiyatullah khayrul lakum. I am the rest of Allah. The rest of Allah is best for you. Although what baqiyatullah means, this term itself requires a lecture in its own right. With your permission, we'll skip this part of the discussion. But it has important meanings that one has to understand. But it's not relevant to our today's lecture and the purpose that I have in this present lecture. Now, what does this lying against the Kaaba, supporting one's back against the Kaaba, that's what the tradition describes that reappearance as. Back to the Kaaba, and then uttering the words, Ana baqiyatullah. What secrets do the traditions want to unfold or disclose here? So what secrets do the traditions want to unfold here? Because it's very precise. Back to the Kaaba, supporting oneself against the Kaaba. It's this clause I want to open up here. Is it merely a historical report of what's going to take place in the future? And it will take place in the future. It's a physical event. It's going to happen one day. The sooner the better, but we don't know. It may be in another 100,000 years. Is it just a piece of history of what is to come that the tradition is mentioning this in such a manner, in such a way? Or is it also outlining a protocol for us to abide by today by using this language in the tradition? He will make his zuhur, his reappearance, back against the Kaaba and say, Ana baghiyatullah. So let's first refer to the Quran as a starting point to help us just open this up a bit. Chapter 5, verse 97. جَعَلَ اللَّهُ الْكَعْبَةَ الْبَيْتَ الْحَرَامِ قِيَامًا لِلنَّاسِ. Allah has assigned the Kaaba as the sacred house as a qiyam for all people, as a support for all people. So the Kaaba here is referred to as support for people to support themselves with, to lie against, to rely upon. And here the 12th Imam appears at such a place which is qiyaman linnas, a support for all, and according to traditions he's going to start his uprising, his qiyam, as the qa'im, the upriser there. Now why should this be? What's the link? What's the harmony between the Kaaba as the support for all people? What's the association between that and the fact that the upriser, Twelfth Imam, His Eminence, will uprise there? Is there any harmony between these two or not? Now here we go to the traditions to help us out. And on many traditions we have different Imams saying, Nahnu Ka'batullah wa Nahnu Qiblatullah. Now things are becoming delicate now. The traditions are saying, we are Allah's Ka'bah. The Imams. We are Allah's Qibla. One prophetic tradition where the Holy Prophet says, Ya Ali, Anta bimanzilatil Ka'aba. O Ali, your status is on a par with that of the Ka'aba. Remember the previous tradition, Nahnu Ka'batullah, we are the Ka'aba. Then he gives a code. This code is very important. That what is meant by the Imam being the Kaaba. Yu'ta ilayha wa la ta'ati. They'll come towards it, but it won't come. The Kaaba, people will go to the Kaaba, not the other way around. The Kaaba doesn't come to them. In another tradition, innama, from an imam, innama ana kal ka'aba. Really, I am like the Ka'aba. Here comes the code. Uqsadu wa la aqsud. I will be intended, but I don't intend. They're the focal point. People will intend them. People will travel to them. People will go to them. But they don't go anywhere. Another tradition, مَثَلُ عَلِيٍ كَمَثَلِ بَيْتِ الْحَرَامِ. The example of Ali is the example of the sacred house, the Kaaba. يُزَارُ وَلَا يَزُورُ. It will be visited, but he won't visit, just like the Kaaba. Now here, so far, we see that the Kaaba has two dimensions to it. There's a physical dimension to the Kaaba, which is the building which is now in Mecca, although Kaaba isn't specific to that, Kaaba is in relation to that space. The space is holy, not necessarily the stone or the building, because that keeps on changing over time. It's not the same as 1400 years ago. The space there is important. The space is holy, and we pray towards that, in that direction. So that's the physical Kaaba, but we have a spiritual Kaaba too. And that's the Imams. Now here, these two are one reality, but in different dimensions. One is a lower dimension, that's the physical Kaaba, and one is of a higher reality, or higher dimension of the same reality, and that's the living Imam. Now, if we compare these two Kaabas together and open and unfold one of them, let's say the physical Kaaba, secrets of the spiritual Kaaba will become evident to us. And that's what I wanted just to, on the margin here. So we have one reality. It's called the Kaaba. It has dimensions depending on the realm of existence. One is the physical existence, it's the physical Kaaba in Mecca. One is the living Imam, the Ma'soom. Now let's see how the physical Kaaba emerged, reappeared. How did the physical Kaaba make its zuhur? And when we see how it made its zuhur, then let's go to its higher reality dimension, and then let's see if anything opens up for us. On the 25th of Dhul Qa'dah every year, the 11th month of the lunar, Islamic lunar calendar, it's a day that they call Dahwul Ard, the scattering of the earth. And what that means is that the earth, and by earth I mean the surface area of the earth, the whole surface area of the earth was covered in water. And then on the 25th of the 11th month, one year, many thousands of years ago, the first opening of the dry surface area of the earth started and opened up. And that opening is called, that scattering of water which opens up the dry surface area of earth is called Dahwul Ard. Dah means scattering, opening of earth. Earth in the Quran usually means the surface area, not the planet earth. In chapter 91, verse 6, Wal arde wa ma tahaha, swears by the earth and him who spread it. In the traditions, it goes into detail how the water spread, how it scattered, opening up the first surface area, because the whole surface area of the earth was covered in water. For the first time, dry surface area, dry land appeared. In our cycle of humankind, the cycle of Adam, that dry surface area, that land, was Mecca, was where the Kaaba is today, that space. That was the first dry land which appeared after that total locking of water. And according to the majority perspective, Adam, the first human being, was created from the earth of that dry land. So the earth was covered in water, and then the opening started. Who appeared? What reappeared? The Kaaba. That space reappeared. after a total covering of water, it reappeared. And then, from that dry land, it scattered. Before it was 100% covered in water, now, after maybe hundreds or thousands of years, it became only 80% of the surface area being covered with water, 20% being dry land. And it spread in a certain direction. The traditions go into that. Now that's one dimension of the reality of the Kaaba. But the Kaaba has other dimensions too. One of them being the spiritual Kaaba, the Imam. And the Kaaba, in whatever dimension it is, since the reality is one, نَحْنُ كَعْبَةُ اللَّهِ. The dimensions differ, the reality is one. Formally extracted in relation to the lower dimensions of the Kaaba can be executed in relation to the higher dimensions of the Kaaba, because they're one in essence. So here, with the spiritual Kaaba, what we see, when the spiritual Kaaba wants to do the zuhur and reappear, in the same way that the physical Kaaba reappeared when the earth was covered and drowned in water, the spiritual Kaaba will also reappear when the earth is covered in injustice and drowned in oppression and so on and so forth. Now, here, with the physical Kaaba, the traditions go how it's scattered, in which direction scattered. Dry land becoming more and more after the opening of the dry land started, became more and more. So now the question is, how will the spread or the direction of the spiritual Kaaba on reappearing, what direction will that take? Here the answer to this may lie in Ashura. So let's go one step back and we'll return to this later. Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad wa ajalli faraja. He was also Ka'batullah. And he was ready to do his Qiyam, his uprising. To execute the Qiyam, he also had to support himself against the Kaaba, which is Qiyam al-Nas. And from Medina, he went to Mecca. Before the uprising started, he first went to Mecca. Whoever wants to accomplish the zuhur must first do an uprising. They must do a qiyam. Every zuhur is preceded by a qiyam. Zuhur meaning manifesting Allah's attributes, not only in oneself, but permeating it through society. Society has to be filled with Allah's attributes. This qiyam had to take place in Mecca. One has to rely and support oneself against the Kaaba before permeating the truth throughout society. So the Imam Hussein alayhi salam, went to Mecca, and there he would say, "Ana baghiyatullah." In one of his speeches there, he said, "Whoever wants to do a qiyam with me and to unite with Allah, being manifestations of Allah's attributes and permeating Allah's attributes throughout society, making that zuhur happen, they have to come and travel with me." And the whole story of Karbala was a story of Allah's attributes manifesting maximally. That's why the purpose was attained there. two marginal points again, and then we'll come back to the story again. One may ask, okay, what about today, in the period of occultation, ghaiba, what's the duty there? Well, there too, we have to rely upon the Kaaba. But if it's not the physical Kaaba, it has to be the spiritual Kaaba. Whoever wants to do a qiyam, whoever wants to succeed in permeating Allah's attributes through society, they have to rely upon and be supportive against the 12th Imam. Now that will be opened up a bit later, inshallah, on how that can happen. Another meaning one can use in relation to this qiyam, this uprising that one has to do before that zuhur is actualized, is the qiyam of the heart. The heart has to undergo an uprising. The forces of Iblis have to be fought against, have to be revolted against. Fais Kashani describes Iblis in a very delicate manner in Al-Wafi, which is a commentary to the traditions of Al-Kafi. You know, in Al-Kafi, which is a book of traditions compiled by Khulaini, there, in the first chapter, it speaks of the army of Iblis, or to be exact, the army of Jahl, ignorance. And he calls these the army of Iblis. And there are about 75 or 74, I can't remember now, attributes that if you acquire within yourself, to the proportion that you incorporate these vicious attributes, you are creating Iblis within. And you are being in unity with Iblis. And actually, you are Iblis. Don't think that Iblis has to be, according to Fais Kashani, this entity outside you, waiting to punish you or hit you. That's also one perspective, it's okay. But the real threat is within. And actually, it's in your own hands, how your actions are. You are your actions. Only you. لَيْسَ لِلْإِنسَانِ إِلَّا مَا سَعَى. You are but that which you strive for. That will be embodied in the metaphysical realms. And it can be embodied as Iblis. You created your own Iblis. You made yourself Iblis. The more you incorporate those vicious attributes, the more Iblisi you become. You have to uprise. It's a spiritual journey to destroy that army of Iblis within. So that's another description of Qiyam. Okay, so Imam Hussein alayhi salam said, whoever wants to do Qiyam with me, uprise with me, and to unite with Allah. That's uniting with Allah, meaning zuhur indirectly, in the manner that one incorporates Allah's attributes and then spreads it throughout society. Come and travel with me. Now this qiyam which Imam Hussein alayhi salam wanted to execute, this entails fighting against oppression. That's at least part of the story. Now that oppression in society, it's going to involve bloodshed. It's not going to be pretty. And blood can't be spilled in Mecca. It's holy ground. You can't do that. So Imam Hussein, he traveled out of Mecca. In the same way that the Kaaba, when it reappeared, then the dry land kept on spreading in a certain direction. Here too, with his qiyam, he went to Mecca, he did his qiyam there, but then he had exit maker, because blood was about to be spilled. It intends fighting against oppression. So, one must lie against the Kaaba, support oneself against the Kaaba, before spreading that justice to society, to make Allah's rules govern for that zuhur to happen. Where does one go? Well, where did Imam Hussein go? That was where the oppressors are, where the forces of global arrogance are. That's the journey. If you want zuhur to happen, this is the route. Zuhur can't happen without qiyam. After the qiyam, the place where he went, it was towards Kufa, and he ended in Karbala, it was where the forces of oppression, global arrogance at that time, resided. So, like that, now you can appreciate that spread, the direction where the 12th Imam will go, when he will reappear after his Qiyam in Mecca. Now let's just take it from another angle now. We said on previous nights that the story of the Imams, the story of the Prophets, they're all stories of man. It's man's identity which is being unfolded. It's the story of the soul. It doesn't have to be confined to a biographical or historical discussion. It will happen one day, the coming. If you're limited to that, we're losing the plot. Then we said, the Imams, the Prophets, therefore the 12th Imam is an intermediary. And we opened up that concept of the luminous barzakh, nurturing us from moment to moment, a manifestation of Allah's rububiyyah, He is Rabb. Now the more our actions accord with such an intermediary, such a balance, the more our actions conform with the divine protocols brought by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, the more we travel to Allah and to the Imam. Remember, Yuzaru wa la yazur, to the same proportion of our traveling and conforming our actions with that divinity, to the same proportion, the 12th Imam will reappear before us today. Now this I want to open up. We don't have to wait for something which may happen in 100,000 years time. It's going to be a pity if you confine messianism to that. That's not exactly going to be spiritually uplifting. It has some benefits, but it's going to be minimal. The more you conform your actions with this intermediary, with the divine protocols, with the Sharia, with the Tariqah, to the extent that you go towards Allah, to the same extent, the 12th Imam will reappear before you. This is our slogan. Now, how will he reappear? Does it have to be a physical reappearing? The answer is no. That physical reappearing will happen. It's a definite. No one's denying that. But we don't know when it's going to happen. Try and not get distracted with these signs that, you know, every now and again people keep on bringing up. You're just losing the whole plot if you go into the signs. It's no use. There is use, but it's minimal. So how will the Imam reappear today? We have to go through the traditions now. An-Nazaru ila wajh Ali ibadatu. See? The keys are here now. Seeing towards ila the face of Amir al-Mu'mineen is ibadah. Right, now, first of all, this question is, many of the Munafiqeen would see Amir al-Mu'mineen every day. Was that ibadah? Definitely not. It wasn't the physical seeing. Not to say that the physical seeing is bad, no. But if we just confine this to a physical seeing, first of all, it's not true. Because many monophysites would be with Amir al-Mu'mineen and see Amir al-Mu'mineen every day. But that was no kind of ibadah for them. Actually, they would become worse people. Secondly, do we have to say that this tradition has become extinct? Doesn't this very tradition exist for us 1400 years later? Can this apply to us? Well, of course it can. These traditions are miracles of the Imams. They're luminous words. It's much more important than, remember, that classification between the verbal and the practical miracles. These are the main miracles. What use is it for us to see a practical miracle? We're already converted, we're already convinced. But these make people grow. Was it the physical Amir al-Mu'mineen intended here or not? Well, today, the physical Amir al-Mu'mineen, he's passed away. He passed away 1400 years ago. So what Ali, alayhi salam, is this? That we can travel towards and nazaru ilo wajh Ali. This ilo means towards. Prepositions in the Qur'an are important. The irfan of the Qur'an and the traditions, its irfan is hidden in the prepositions. Otherwise the nouns and verbs, it's easy to translate. In the Hawza, in the seminaries, for years we study books on Arabic grammar. There's one book called Mughni al-Labib. Has 8 chapters. The Hawza today only studies chapters 1 and 4, but chapter 1 takes a year and they never finish it. And it goes through all the prepositions one by one. If you have an ustad with taste, they can go through the esoteric dimensions explained in many of the prepositions in that book for you. It's actually one of the most sweetest of books to do. And just speaking about the Hawza, a very dear brother and friend of mine, Hujjat al-Islam wal-Muslimin Amin Rastani, is in our presence, alhamdulillah, and he's going to start speaking, I think, from Tuesday night. Someone that I have utmost respect towards, very ethical, although I apologize before him for mentioning this in his presence, but very moderate, someone that everyone can benefit from, especially the youth. And since I'm leaving on Wednesday, inshallah, I will be here also on Tuesday night with you all to listen to his commencement of his speeches. So, an-nadaru ila wajh Ali ibadatun. You have to travel to Ali. That ila doesn't mean a physical traveling. Because there is no physical Amir al-Mu'mineen with us now. It must be a spiritual traveling, an esoteric traveling, to see a vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen, that barzakhi Amir al-Mu'mineen. That's open. It was open then, it's open to everyone today. Those traditions those stories that speak of Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam being present in 40 different places at the same time. Okay? That can't be the physical Amir al-Mu'mineen. You can't have 40 physical Amir al-Mu'mineen. That goes against the law of transitivity. You can't have 40 people with 40 bodies and brains and say that this is this. Two different individuals. Here, Ayatollah Hassan Zade Amuli, he explains it. I've also seen it in the tafsir of Ayatollah Jawadi Amuli. He says, those 40 Amir al-Mu'mineen before 40 people in 40 different places were visions, were apparitions of Amir al-Mu'mineen that those 40 people saw at the same time. They had raised their degree of faith. They saw their Imam. They don't have to be physically with the Imam. They were far from the Imam, but they saw the Imam. That vision of Amir al-Mu'mineen spiritually builds you, whereas physically seeing Amir al-Mu'mineen, no, there's no guarantee. An-nazaru ila wajhi Ali. Then we go to the Quran. فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهَا بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. Now we've spoken about this. Archangel Gabriel appeared before Lady Maryam, was in unity with Lady Maryam, was a product of the Mi'raj of Lady Maryam. She saw Archangel Gabriel, not with the physical eye, with the eye that we see in our sleep, but she was awake. As a result of what did she see? As a result of one's Mi'raj. You ascend, you accord your actions with the divine protocol, you ascend, you increase your spirituality, you can travel and see Amir al-Mu'mineen. You can see Archangel Gabriel. The capacity is there. These are explicit traditions and verses of the Quran. Now, is the 12th Imam is higher in degree than Archangel Gabriel. Essence of the Mahdi is higher in degree. Allahumma sallallahu. It's higher. Now, in the same way that angels can appear before a million people at the same time, the same way that Amir al-Mu'mineen appeared before many people at the same time in the semi-immaterial souls of those people, or in the semi-immaterial realm of those people's existences. In the same way that Nakir al-Munkar, if a million people die at the same time, will appear before those million people, here the 12th Imam can appear before us as a vision, as an apparition. فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهَا بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. The lam here, another preposition. The lam of unity. Lam or rabt. It was in unity with the soul of Maryam. A result of her mi'raj, she ascended to metaphysical, immaterial realms, received divine knowledge, immaterial. Then the soul converted it into semi-immaterial images, pictures, with a message. It was Archangel Gabriel giving her a message. Amir al-Mu'mineen before those 40 people with a message. The 12th Imam before us with a message. Once this zuhur of the Imam before us, once this happens and the Mahdi manifests before you to X degree, whatever X is, with Y message, until the next moment of your life, until the next day of your life, depending on what X is. So to the degree that he manifests before you, فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهُ بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا, to that degree, with whatever message he brings for you, as a result of you ascending. Until the next moment of your life, until the next day of your life, until the next month in your life, until the next year, here you shall be undergoing true intedor and awaiting for your emor. If it happens once, not an academic awaiting, that he will come, we are waiting for him. That's academic. At best it's a rational thing. This is a state of ecstasy. This will be a state of intoxication. Once it happens, you're going to be waiting. Either next year, next month, next day. But you're out of control now. You're truly awaiting for the emor. You've seen once it happens once. There's a reason why intizar is the hardest of actions according to traditions. Is the best of actions according to other traditions. There's a reason for this. It's not a rational exercise. Once it happens, you're going to be in ecstasy, waiting for that next moment. The higher that X is, that degree of the Imam's zuhur before you, the more out of control you will be. Otherwise, what will you see the physical Imam be? Let's say you see the physical Imam, even before his physical reappearance. So what? What's that going to do? I'm sure many people may have seen him, but we don't recognize him. It's not exactly spiritually elevating, just seeing him. As it wasn't for Amir al-Mu'mineen, when the Munafiqeen would see him. A physical seeing isn't spirit building. But having a vision of the Imam does build the spirit. And that building of the spirit can take you to dangerous levels, intoxify you. Now, the Imam also is waiting. For whom? For what? How? It's like the teacher who awaits the student to prepare the grounds of receiving that grace and development from the teacher. The Imam is waiting for us. If the grounds aren't prepared by us to receive those visions of the Imam today, to receive the zuhur of the Imam, we are not true waiters. We're not those who are truly awaiting. The soul must be prepared to receive visions of the Imam. Intidar, this awaiting, is a function of the soul. It's an immaterial, it's an aqli endeavor. It's eternal, there's no end to it. It's infinite. The truth of intidar is traced back to the soul. It's a function of the soul. It's a function of your mi'raj. As-salatu mi'raj al-mu'min. It's open to everyone. Don't suffice with the physical intidar. If you suffice with that, it's a minimum. Intidar isn't a worldly concept alone. We have to do the true intidar in order to perceive and elevate. But the dead soul isn't waiting. There's no awaiting by the dead soul. And there'll be no benefit, even if they were to see the Imam in the physical form, there's no benefit whatsoever. In the tradition, man arafa nafsa, arafa rabba, one who acquires irfan, gnosis with a G, of one's soul, it's a function of the soul. One sees one's Lord. Other traditions help to define this tradition. من عرف نفسه عرف ولیه. Will acquire gnosis of one's imam, of one's wali. How? Those who have a gnosis of oneself. Intidar, which allows to have visions of the imam and benefit from the imam, is a function of the soul. It's the miraj of the soul. It's an immaterial reality. Take it out of this worldly definition and limitations. Finally, is the question of ghaiba, occultation. Now this is why I was explaining the concept of the luminous barzakh for the last 2 days, so that this becomes easier to digest. Oops. This occultation which they speak of, this has to be explained. And this is just one perspective. Don't panic if it's, you know, something totally maybe new to you, or it's only one perspective, one understanding of true ghiba, occultation, what it's all about, essentially. We say the imam is an occultation. Now, the imam is a manifestation of Allah's grace, Allah's mercy, Allah's generosity. Why should he have to be in ghaiba? Why does he have to be in occultation? Is the imam miserly? Na'udhu billah. Is he hiding away from us? He's all mercy. He's all karam. What does it mean when we attribute these terms such as occultation, ghaiba, to the intermediary of Allah? Why should he be in ghaiba? Now, remember when we spoke about the intermediary, the luminous barzakh? We said they are the people's mirror to Allah. And they are Allah's mirror to the people. I won't repeat it again, but... So in those stories of the Quran where superficially we see these weaknesses attributed to the prophets, those attributes shouldn't be predicated to those intermediaries or prophets. It's rather should be attributed to the people who they are representing, in the same way that when they are manifesting Allah's attributes and saying, I am this, I am that, giving those divine names and truths to themselves, those divine truths aren't attributed to the essence of those intermediaries themselves. They're Allah's mirror to the people. And in the same way, all the weaknesses ought to be attributed to the Prophet. The Prophet is the people's Prophet. As the people's Prophet, he takes the weakness of the people and goes to Allah, ascends to Allah, then returns from Allah with that divine protocol to the people. Here, ghaibat, occultation, has to be understood via this concept of the luminous barzakh, in that he's not in occultation. The 12th Imam, this is quite a delicate point, and it's the final point, I promise. This occultation, he's not in occultation. We, the people, through which he is the intermediary. It's okay, let them do it, but I just don't want your concentration because this is the final point and it's an important point. But it's okay, as long as you don't get distracted. The Imam, as our intermediary today, He's not in occultation. Okay? We are in occultation. We are asleep. We are hiding. And also Niyamun Ida Matu Intabahu. People are asleep. When they die, only then they become aware. The goal is that we have to ascend in this world spiritually. Remember, mutu qabla an tamutu. Has to be done now. Only then we can have those visions. We can spiritually benefit. The Imam, the 12th Imam, is the intermediary between Allah and us. He takes the weaknesses that we have, ascends to Allah, has his mi'raj. That weakness with Yunus, the people had X weakness. With Prophet Ibrahim, it was another weakness, that lack of tranquility of the heart. Here, the weakness that we have, that the Imam, as our representative, as the people's mirror to Allah, is occultation. But we are hiding. We are asleep. He takes it to Allah, spiritually ascends, then now he comes back as Allah's mirror to the people. Now what's his message when he's coming back to the people, me and you? فَتَمَثَّلَ لَهُ بَشَرًا سَوِيًّا. The same way that Archangel Gabriel came and gave a message to Maryam alayhi salam and to others, there we can acquire the message from our 12th Imam. He can execute the zuhur before us, that vision, that apparition, and he can guide us. And that's the whole aim. The fact that we can't say, oh, but we're not receiving anything and we're not seeing him, well, that's our loss. We're not truly awaiting. The whole aim is to spiritually elevate, to practice the Sharia to the dot, to practice the tariqa to the dot. You do that when the Imam, as Allah's mirror to the people, he will manifest before you, in unity with you, as a vision, that semi-immaterial, that barzakhi reality. And he will give you the message. What's the message? Depends how you elevate it. On a par, in proportion to your elevation towards Allah, you will receive. And then occultation may lose meaning in relation to you then. And then awaiting then finds its true meaning. And that was the point I wanted to mention in relation to Messianism, that the road is open. There's no need to put religion on credit. One day it will happen. That's no point. Religion is for us to breathe Islam day after day, minute, moment after moment. And the potential is great. And this is the meaning of that zuhur of the 12th Imam. A zuhur which is practical today. Okay, you've been very patient. I'll just read a few du'as and then do zikr musibat inshallah. Oh Allah, we're all weak. Strengthen us in faith. We're all sinners. Make us resist all satanic temptations within us. Oh Allah, guide us on the straight path. Oh Allah, make us benefit spiritually from His Eminence, the presence of the Imam, to any degree that you know is befitting for us. Make us travel towards him. Oh Allah, the deceased members of our family and friends, enlighten their souls. Protect all Muslims against all oppressors throughout the world. And protect our leader from the global forces of arrogance. Bin Nabiyyi wa alayhi salawat. Okay, just I'll end with a few words of Musibat and then inshallah. Yes. Shimr ibn Dhiljawshan, La'natullah alayh, he fought on Amirul Mu'mineen's side in the Battle of Siffin in the year 40 post-Hijra. And he fought alongside Hussein. They were on the same side. But in the year 60, Shimr went to Karbala and he wrote two letters to Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad, the then governor of Kufa. In the first letter, Shimr wrote that this Umar ibn Sa'd is talking with Hussein behind the curtains. He wants to gain authority of the city of Ray, and simultaneously he wants to lay a route of escape for Imam Hussein so that Imam Hussein does not die. Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad got furious and then sent a letter back to Umar ibn Sa'd stating, on receiving this letter, you either get his allegiance or you finish him off. Otherwise, the city of Ray will go to Shimr. When Umar ibn Sa'd read the letter, he told Shimr, damn you, I wanted to finish matters in peace. Why did you have to ruin things? Now I'm forced to actively engage in battle with Hussein and kill him. In the second letter to Ubaydullah, here Shimr informed Ubaydullah ibn Ziyad that this Abbas ibn Ali is of the same tribe as me, Bani Kilab, and they're fighters. Abbas is going to be a difficult barrier to overcome. Try and convince him to flee the scene, and the rest will be easy to terminate. Here, Shem, on receiving the orders, he went on the eve of Ashura to the area where Hussein's tent was erected. He shouted, O Abbas! Shem shouted, O Abbas, I want a word with you and your brothers. Come out. Here, Abbas alayhi salam felt embarrassed in the presence of Imam Hussein with that animal addressing him. Imam Hussein said, go and see what they want from you, Abbas. Abbas left in humiliation. He came face to face with Shimr. On telling Abbas of his plans, Abbas felt angry and cursed Shimr. I am Hussein's slave, he exclaimed. And he left and returned to the tents. Imam Hussein was there in the tents. Here, Abbas was now feeling more ashamed, more embarrassed. Abbas, what's happened? Imam Hussein said. I said to Abbas, initially embarrassed to say anything. And finally, Abbas said they wanted to provide me and my brothers with asylum. Then Hussein, on hearing this with utmost compassion, said, Abbas, they want my blood. Let your brothers go. Abbas, you can go also. It's my blood thereafter. It was here that Abbas could no longer control himself and exploded in tears, crying and lamenting. He would never consider doing such an action. Maybe he recalled the night of the 21st of Ramadan, the night of the martyrdom of Amirul Mu'mineen, when Amirul Mu'mineen summoned Hussein and Abbas, putting their hands in one another's, turning to Abbas and saying, Abbas, don't ever leave Hussein alone. Abbas would never consider leaving Hussein. He lamented when Hussein offered him to leave, cried out loud, O brother, my mother was Zainab's slave, and I am yours. On the day of Ashura, all the members of the Ahlul Bayt, all the companions, all had become martyred. Abbas was left. He would hear the cries for water and the need for help from the women and children in the tents. He couldn't tolerate this further. Once again, he went to seek permission from his Imam to enter the arena. But since Abbas's name and appearance was fearful for the enemy, the women were still relatively calm in Abbas's presence. After all, he was the standard bearer. Imam Hussein would always say, "Ya akhi, anta sahibu lewa'i." Brother, you're my standard bearer. O Abbas, your martyrdom will end all things. Abbas replied, "Qad daqa sadri." My heart is hurting. My heart is restricted. وَسَمِعَتُ مِنَ الْحَيَاةِ. I'm satiated with respect to life. وَأُرِيدُ أَنْ أَتْلُبَ ثَارِي مِنْ هَؤُلَاءِ الْمُنَافِقِينَ. I want to take retaliation against these munafiqeen for the blood that they've spilled. On hearing this, Imam said, "Now you have this objective, Abbas, go ahead. But one final thing. فَاتْلُبْ لَهَؤُلَاءِ الْأَطْفَالِ قَلِيلًا مِنَ الْمَاءِ. Prepare a little water for these children." Abbas went to the Kufan army, trying to speak some sense into them, counseling them, advising them, but to no avail. He then turned to Umar ibn Sa'd and said, "Hussein is the son of the Holy Prophet's daughter. You've killed all his companions and family members. His female family members and children remain. فَسْخُوهُمْ مِنَ الْمَاءِ قَدْ أَخْرَقَ الْدَمَاءُ قُلُوبِهِمْ. Satiate them with some water. This thirst is burning their inside. Why have you shut all access to the water? Especially when he's telling you that if you allow him to leave, he'll go wherever you want." On this address, some soldiers there started to cry, but Shimr reversed the atmosphere without delay by shouting out loud, "Yabna Abi Turab, lo kana wajhul ard kulluhu ma'a wa huwa tahta aydina lama saqaynakum minhu qatratan illa an tadkhulu fi bay'ati Yazid." If the whole surface area of the earth was all water and it was all in our control, Shim said, we won't even give you a drop of water until you pay your allegiance to Yazid. Abbas returned to give Hussein the latest. Meanwhile, the cries were increasing. Abbas couldn't stand for any more. Zeal, religious fervor and anger drove him to mount his horse. He had a water container in hand and went to search for some water. He approached the Euphrates to collect some water. Immediately 4,000 arrowsmen, according to reports, surrounded him. They would fire arrows at him now and again, but this was Abbas without any fear. He fought whoever challenged him. The flag of Islam was standing high. He filled the container with water. And then before returning, he initially wanted to take some water. However, before taking the water, تذكر عطش الحسين وأهل بيته فرمى الماء. He recalled the thirst of his Imam, of the Imam's Ahl Bayt, and discarded the water. He mounted his horse, ready to leave for the camp, where children, women were all awaiting and eager to see him with the water. The attacks towards him were increasing. They He combated them successfully, defeated whoever came towards him. However, during the combats, two soldiers from behind cowardly attacked Abbas unexpectedly, and the two's maneuver led to the amputation of Abbas's right arm. Abbas continued, however, calling out loud, Wallahi in qata'tumu yamini inni uhami abadan andini. I swear by Allah, if you amputate my right arm, by Allah I will eternally support my religion. Wa an imam sadiq al yaqini, I will eternally support my trustworthy imam, who is the imam of certitude. Najl al nabi tahir al amini, the imam who is the offspring of that prophet who was pure and amin. He wasn't saddened in the least. This was Abbas. Water must be conveyed to the Ahlul Bayt. However, similar maneuvers from the soldiers continued until Abbas's left arm was about to be amputated. Abbas suddenly placed a container into his mouth to hold onto it, gripping onto it with his teeth. The attacking Arabsmen, seeing Abbas helpless now, surrounded him, started pouring the arrows at him. One hit the container, another hit his chest. Things were looking grim. Hope in water had lessened for the children and women of Bani Hashim. All of a sudden, someone came and struck his head with an iron bar, making him fall helplessly on the ground from the horse. It was then that he called out to his brother, Alayka minni as-salam ya Aba Abdullah. Hussein came to Abbas, and what a sight he had to see. Abbas's body full of wooden arrows, no arms, face drowned and soaked in blood, no eyes to see. His head was smashed. This was the end of Abbas. And Hussein knew it. He exclaimed, Allah la inkasana zahli wa qallat ilati. Now my back's broken. Nothing's left for me anymore. In contrast with the other shuhada, Hussein buried Abbas at the very location of his martyrdom. And the secrets of this we don't know. Hussein returned to the tents full of sorrow. On reaching the camp, he saw that the soldiers, the animals, had initiated their attacks on the women. And out of nowhere appeared Sakina, whose first question was, Aina Ammil Abbas? Allah la'natullahi ala al-qawm.